You work at Effective Altruism Sweden. Firstly, if someone's not familiar with this term effective altruism, how would you describe what it is exactly?
I guess you could see it as sort of like the combination of two ideas. That's like first that we want to share some resources with others, like so that's the altruism part. But so that's this maybe the sort of like more common you know, view that's been shared by many sort of religions and ideologies and so on throughout history. But then the other part is sort of more distinctive to effective altruism, and this is the effectiveness part, that, you know, we want to use these resources that we allocate to others as effectively as possible. So that's like, I guess, what the sort of big invention of effective altruism is.
And what are some like areas or things that people in effective altruism think are important to look at and try and be altruistic towards?
First of all, I should say that sort of effective altruism has this concept of sort of cause neutrality. So like there are very many causes or problems that you could work on in the world, like, you know, climate change and global poverty, existential risk, and so on. And effective altruists, they say that, like, well, you shouldn't sort of prejudge the question of which of these problems to work on, but you should look at all the problems with a sort of impartial mindset, and then you should work on the one that you find out is the most effective. But so that's the sort of like the first step. But then in practice, the like effective altruists have then identified some causes as especially effective. So one is global poverty, where the idea has been that, well, there are some people in the world who are so poor and lack such basic resources that sort of helping them can be highly effective relative to helping people in the rich world. And then animal welfare is another major cause where, and again, there's the issue there of like this problem being so large and so neglected relative to other problems, that there isn't that many resources going into this problem. And then another big area which has maybe been growing in the last few years is existential risk, so risks that humanity could go extinct, or you know, there could be a big catastrophe from which we would never recover. So yeah, those are the sort of three classical EA cause areas. Then there are others as well, but I think it makes sense to sort of like point to those three.
And if someone wants to help with these areas, sometimes the idea is to like donate money towards it. Sometimes it's to kind of work in the area. But yeah, just to stick with like the first example, if someone is thinking about how to donate and to kind of maximize their impact on the world, and they don't know much about this, like how should someone think about how they should donate and where to send the money?
It is a very tricky question, because like how would you know, like if you're not an expert? So one thing is then that since early on, effective altruists did this research on different charities, and then based on this research they've come up with recommendations. So the maybe most famous organizations that does this work is GiveWell, that works on global poverty and has recommended like some charities as especially effective. I mean, of course, that then means that like you know, if you want to donate to those organizations, that sort of entails then that like you're trusting GiveWell's research, which I personally would do, but this is a question, of course, that one would have to think carefully about which charity recommendation sites are actually trustworthy or not. But in general, it seems like a strategy that makes sense, like in the absence of personal knowledge, that you would sort of like defer to the experts.
You've wrote a bit about like what you see as like the virtues of an effective altruist. So someone engaged in this movement maybe may possess certain virtues to make them suitable. Can you explain that a little bit?
We have certain common sense virtues like honesty and kindness and loyalty and so on. And with this work that I did on the sort of virtues on effective altruism, like virtues of effective altruism, like I guess I wanted to emphasize like two things. Like so the first thing is that, like, well, by and large, we should sort of like, we should engage in those common sense virtues, like, because so this is something I've thought about in the context of sort of naive effective altruists, you might say. So by that I mean the sort of interpretation, which I think is erroneous, the interpretation of effective altruists, where you think that sort of like, because you want to sort of maximize do-gooding, it doesn't matter if you sort of lie or steal or sort of like engage in other forms of dubious behavior, like, because it's fine to do that, like, if you like maximize the greater good. And I think this is highly problematic for several reasons. Like, I mean, for one thing, I think it often backfires in the end. So that's the first thing I wanted to say, that sort of like stick with those virtues. But then and this was also work that I did with Lucius Caviola, who has been my main collaborator for several years. Then we also wanted to say that, like, well, you, in addition to those common sense virtues, you also want to have other virtues, because like common sense ethics doesn't sort of emphasize, for instance, the importance of effectiveness. And we're saying that, well, that is actually very important. So like, yeah, so going back to what we said at the start, so like with the, you know, the altruism and the effectiveness part of effective altruism, I think that to an extent, like common sense ethics does emphasize altruism, but it doesn't emphasize effectiveness. And it's actually, effectiveness is actually tremendously important, like, because the ultimate goal is to help the beneficiaries, like, you know, to help people out there in the world. And if you're doing that less effectively, like, then, you know, many people who could have been helped won't be helped. But then there are also other virtues. I could get into that if you wanted.
Common sense ethics, it's, you know, it helps with the altruism part, but we're not very well equipped to necessarily do it effectively. Why is that? Why are we not good at remembering this other, you know, very important part? Let's actually make it effective. What's the psychology around that?
So that's a good question. Like, I mean, that relates to this research that I did also with Lucius for several years on the sort of the psychology of effective altruism. So we wrote this book on about this, which is called Effective Altruism and the Human Mind. And in fact, like, that book focuses on this like effectiveness part of effective altruism, because we thought that, like, well, there is already a lot of research on why people aren't more altruistic, or like why they are altruistic to the extent that they are, but there isn't a lot of research on the effectiveness part. So we thought that we'd do research on that and then compile it into a book. So with regards to your questions, like, so one thing is that sort of altruistic sacrifices, like, you know, that you're giving some resources to some other person, that's very visible and salient. Like, it's very clear that, like, you know, now Joe is being altruistic and helpful. He's giving resources to others. Whereas, like, in many cases, if you're giving more effectively or less effectively, that's just much less observable. Like, it's less, often less clear, like, that, you know, what you did wasn't very effective. So that is one sort of underlying reason for this.
Is there a way that we can become more kind of psychologically equipped to be more effective? Like, what are some tools we can have in our minds of how to think about things better, so we're not just altruistic, but we're effectively altruistic?
I do actually think that this is not that easy. maybe I should tell you a little bit about background, like the background of our research. So what we think is basically that one sort of obstacle to effectiveness in the charity domain is basically like the norms that we have around charity. So So people think that, like, when it comes to charity, it's basically you don't have any obligation to be effective, like, and you know, you're even encouraged to sort of like go with your heart, and so on. So, and that's a fairly sort of strong norm that people have, and that means that, like, people are not necessarily like averse to effective altruists per se. Like, I mean, obviously some people are, but I think that, like, most people think that, like, this is a fine approach to take, but it's just not for me. Like, it's fine if you do it, but, like, it's just not something that, like, most people want to adopt, because they want to continue with this sort of standard charity mindset just going with their hearts and so on. Then we did some research where we sort of like looked at sort of attitudes to certain sort of very basic statements, sort of like, well, it's important to help more rather than fewer, like, if you could. I don't remember the exact phrasings now, but, like, you know, very, very basic statements like this, which didn't involve any sort of specific effective altruist charities and so on. And then we looked at sort of like how different people answer on these questions. And then we found that there is a sort of like subsection of the general population which sort of like answers in a more sort of effective altruist aligned way, and we call these the sort of the effective altruist enthusiasts in our book. So so a natural strategy is obviously, like, you know, to reach out to those people, but like I said, like, I think that, like, both our research but also effective altruism outreach work over the years have sort of shown that it's not very straightforward to sort of convince people of the importance of effectiveness.
Yeah, and you mentioned that you did this research as part of your book with your collaborator Lucius Caviola. Yeah, effective altruism in the human mind, the clash between impact and intuition.
Yeah.
Can you lay out any other kind of key insights that you kind of put in this book that you learned whilst researching it so in depth?
I guess, like, one thing that I wanted to get across there is really the importance of these norms, this sort of like how we conceive of charity. So there, because there is a sort of like a standard model of explaining this behavior, like, you know, that people don't donate effectively, but also sort of a standard model that I think is used in the social sciences more generally, and that is a model where you have two factors, and there's, like, on the one hand there are the beliefs, and on the other hand there's sort of like the preferences in a sort of narrow sense, you might say. So the beliefs, that's straightforward, like, people just don't know what the effective charities are, and, like, they have numerous other misconceptions about charity. And then on the other hand, like, people have these like preferences or like strong feelings for specific causes like cancer research or so on. But we think that those two factors are actually in themselves insufficient to explain this behavior, because you can look at how people behave in other contexts. Like, I mean, maybe the best example is sort of civil servants or like other government staff, you know. Of course, they also have they can also have the same preferences sort of in other contexts. And, like, also, like, initially, they're typically uninformed, you know, when they approach a new topic. But, you know, they overcome these obstacles. They do the research, and, you know, even if they feel more strongly for cancer research, like, you know, if sort of the ministers tell them to sort of to go with a certain metric of effectiveness, like, they do that. So we think that you need to add this third factor, which is this norm that you don't have to be highly effective when it comes to charity. But it's more like, you know, you do as you feel. I should say that it's important to notice that, like, first of all, like, if you ask people to rate their criteria, for like why they donate the way they do and so on, they actually mention effectiveness. So it's not the case that people are sort of like explicitly anti effectiveness. And it's also the case that if you're sort of like directly wasteful, that's something that people don't like. Sort of like they don't really, and like that may also be a reason why many people sort of focus on the overhead costs, where they feel like that, you know, overhead costs are sort of administration costs and high salaries and so on to charities. So there is like an interest in ineffectiveness for sure, but it's like basically not sort of strong enough to sort of overcome these other preferences that people have for like specific charities or so.
That's super interesting. So maybe it's a bit more explicit. If you ask someone, you know, how should we think about donating to charity, they'll think and they'll say effectiveness, but when caught up in the moment, when doing it themselves, it's a bit more forgotten. They maybe just forget about it more when they're actually acting it out and are drawn more by emotions. But when they reflect, they would say, of course, be effective. Is that perhaps something that's going on?
I think that's part of what's going on. I mean, that said, like I shouldn't sort of exaggerate like how strongly people are sort of like saying from an explicit point of view that sort of effectiveness is important, but like you know, some of them might actually sort of endorse the view that like sometimes you just shouldn't be effective sort of like more explicitly, but I do think that there is something to what you're saying, and I think that this is also happening sometimes when you sort of introduce some people to effective altruism, that they sort of like they like the concept, but then like, oh, does that mean all of these things that I have to give up these other views that I have, and I'm not comfortable with doing that. So yeah, I think there's something to that.
Yeah, if someone's not at all familiar with effective altruism and you know, but they are someone that has given to charity quite a few times in their life, what are some of the key motivating factors that actually influence them often to go to charity? I mean, the cliche one I often hear is something like, you'll donate to a cause that caused like a family member to be very ill or die, and it's this kind of emotional, like intimate reason. Is this a good example, and what are some other reasons that people haven't maybe reflected so much are kind of driven towards certain causes?
It depends a bit on like how you're thinking about this issue. Like, I mean, there could be very many factors that influence people. Like, I mean, sometimes, you know, people donate to sort of these charities that sort of approach you in the street, and which I also guess says something about people's attitude to charity, because like most people would probably not do the same with, you know, if they were buying something for themselves, they would probably be a bit more sort of cautious and so on. But like, I do think it's important though to say that like my view is that, you know, people actually have this sort of altruistic impulse. They do want to help others. That is something that sort of like underlies charitable giving. So I guess like more generally, like I don't want to sort of like there is a sort of bit more of a cynical take on the sort of psychology of altruism and the psychology of effective altruism, and that sort of like that people are not so effective, that shows that they, you know, they don't really care at all. So like I don't really think that's true, but I do think that people care, but then because of like it's actually like, I mean, one thing is that it's just very hard also to be effective, so you need to be really focused to be effective, and most people aren't up to that level that's required, basically.
One thing you've looked at specifically is the psychology of long-termism and extreme and existential risks, sorry. Firstly, for anyone who doesn't know this, could you just briefly explain what long-termism and existential risk is? And then, yeah, maybe tell us a bit about your research into the psychology of these two specific cause areas.
So long-termism is this... I mean, I guess growing philosophy that which says that, you know, we should care about the very long-term future, and often it also involves the notion that sort of like the long-term future could be very good, so therefore it could be like very important to make sure that it goes well. And then existential risk is this associated concept, which is that, well, humanity could either go extinct, or there could be just a big catastrophe from which we would never recover. And from a long-termist perspective, it's sort of like especially important to prevent existential catastrophes, like which would result from existential risk, because not only would it sort of harm or kill all present people, but it would also mean that this like potentially great future would never come into existence. So those are two key concepts.
What psychological insights have you had to the way people care about these issues and want to work on them or donate towards them?
Yeah, so we had one paper where we looked at this thought experiment from Derek Parfit. So Derek Parfit was this famous Oxford philosopher, and he had this like typical philosophical thought experiment, which sort of involved then three outcomes. So one was just peace, and then the second one was a nuclear war, which killed 99%, and the third one was a nuclear war which killed everyone on Earth. And then he asked the reader, like, well, he told the reader first that sort of like obviously peace is the best outcome, and the war that kills everyone is the worst outcome, and the war that kills nearly everyone is like in between. But so that part was clear, but then the question he was interested in was like, which difference is the largest, like that between no one dying and nearly everyone dying, or that between nearly everyone dying and everyone dying? And then he sort of predicted that most people would think that the difference between no one dying and 99% dying would be this sort of the larger in terms of sort of moral badness. Because, you know, that's the larger one in terms of number of deaths. But he himself thought that the second difference between 99% and 100% dying was the larger one, because, like, if we went extinct, then we could never recover, and that would mean that the future would never come into existence. So basically, you know, there was a neat psychological hypothesis there to test. And what we found was that sort of like in our standard setup, where we just asked this question in a fairly straightforward way, like we actually changed the numbers, for instance, from 99, the number of deaths in the middle outcome from 99% to 80%, and we made some other minor changes. But like overall, we sort of like we tested Parfit's hypothesis more or less as it was in his text. And what we found that was that then when we asked this question in a more straightforward way, then yeah, Parfit turned out to be right. So people did think that the difference between no one dying and 80% dying was the larger one. But then when we sort of prompted people to think through the implications for the long-term future, that like, you know, this people could actually recover from this catastrophe that didn't lead to human extinction, then like more people started to think that, like, well, actually the difference between near extinction catastrophe and the extinction catastrophe, that's the larger one. So it seems that like people, they don't really think through the long-term implications of catastrophes. They focus on the sort of like the immediate consequences. That's one upshot of this research.
Do you think there are many other like key reasons why people, you know, because it feels to me like seem to not maybe take the idea of existential threat and extinction risks like maybe seriously enough? And I wondered if like, it feels like people have a bit of a hard time appreciating often like exponential growth in things, maybe because it's quite abstract and quite an uncommon thing. Do you think maybe the abstractness and the uncommonness is, or maybe even I don't know if this is, I'm really speculating here, maybe it's not, you know, maybe a very particularly nice thing to think about. Like, are any of these some of the reasons you think why maybe we just don't really take seriously enough the idea that things could go very, very wrong?
It's a pretty difficult question. And I guess I think that it depends a little bit on like what risks we're talking about. Because like if you look at climate change, for instance, there is actually quite a bit of attention that's being paid to climate change. And if we look at nuclear war, like during the Cold War, there was quite a bit of attention. I mean, then one can always discuss, like, was there enough attention and like given the risks and so on. But I think that I wouldn't say that sort of like just people neglect it entirely. It could be that like there are certain characteristics of specific risks that, you know, make them more liable to be neglected. So some people have speculated that that's true of artificial intelligence risks, for instance, that sort of like it's less intuitive perhaps that artificially intelligent systems could, you know, constitute an extinction risk. But that as well is, like, I guess it remains to be seen a bit, like the current systems are not as advanced as sort of future systems will be. And, you know, I think that it will become more intuitive that these systems could be dangerous in the future. Then there's the question of sort of like how intuitive will people find that, but I think it will change.
Okay, so yeah, maybe it's more about the specific risk than generally, as you say. Something like AI is a little bit harder for the average person to wrap their head around than nuclear, which seems a bit more easy to relate, like kind of imagine the bad consequences of.
Yes, I think it matters a lot of like, you know, how salient the risk is. Like, and I mean, I think there was like Stuart Russell who compared AI risk with sort of like if you heard that there is like a fleet of aliens that is, you know, will invade Earth in sort of like some years to come, then like people would freak out. So, I mean, there are other differences between that and the AI scenario. But I do think that like if we just take that scenario in isolation, the alien scenario, I think it is true that like then people would freak out a lot, because like this is just triggers all this, you know, ancient psychological mechanism relating to sort of like fear of an enemy invader or so. So, yeah, so I guess that example makes clear that it's sort of probably highly depends on the nature of the risk.
While we're on this point about AI, am I correct that you kind of coin the term sleepwalk bias?
Yeah.
Really interesting. Could you explain what that is and maybe how it relates perhaps to at least some people's thoughts around what's going on in AI and AI safety and so on?
This idea that I had back in 2016 that like, when people think about catastrophic risk and when they talk about catastrophic risk, they sometimes neglect or underestimate the role of sort of like our future responses to these risks. So this sort of plays out in a number of different ways. So it's sort of like actually sometimes people, like even in scientific papers, like people can sort of like make claims where it's sort of unclear if they mean that this is what's actually going to happen, or if they're saying that this is what would happen if we wouldn't do anything about it. Like, but that's like actually a really important distinction, because like, of course, if there's a big risk, like, you know, we will do something about it. And so that's the one part. And then the other part is just sort of a general pessimism about like our ability to respond, or like our willingness to respond. And like there one can have more of a discussion. Like, I mean, the first part there, I think, like, is just, that's just wrong to sort of like ignore the response altogether. So but with regards to sort of how strong the response is going to be, there we can have a discussion. But my view is that many people underestimate that response, and not only with regards to AI risk, but also with regards to climate change and so on. I think there's a little bit of a sort of selection effect going on here, that like often the people who focus on a risk are the ones that are sort of like the most pessimistic, and then they might be sort of like more inclined to sort of like underestimate this social response. So basically I think that key actors, including governments, are often like more rational than many people realize.
To what extent do you think sleepwalk bias is present in the AI safety space?
I think that like over the years, I have seen some of it. I think I don't want to sort of go into sort of like how frequent it is, but I do think that this is something that I observed, and I've also noticed that sort of some people have been surprised by the extent to which like governments have already taken an interest in AI risk. So that seems to suggest perhaps that people were a bit overly pessimistic about that previously.
Yeah, that does seem to be the case. I hear a lot of people very surprised at how things have very quickly been helped by government, and look at all this happening. So it does show some people were pessimistic.
But then I think that like the natural next step, if you notice that, is that like you should go back to your own thinking, like, and sort of like maybe there's something wrong in my entire worldview here, actually. Like, you know, it's actually a quite important question here that people were plausibly wrong about, and then maybe they should reevaluate their view of sort of like how governments work. And
okay, so back to a few more things about effective altruism a bit more broadly. Firstly, obviously you've been interested in this idea, this concept, this movement for a long time. How has your thinking about it changed over the years?
I discovered effective altruism back in 2014 when I was at London School of Economics, and I started going to meetups, and I went to my first EA summit in the Bay Area in 2014, and at first when you encounter effective altruism, then it's sort of like a fairly abstract concept. And I think it wasn't like before I started working for the Center for Effective Altruism in 2016 that I sort of like really understood things at the deeper level, like, and what you know, what people were working on and so on. I guess like I was actually pretty impressed by like how carefully people have thought about like all kinds of different issues of like, you know, how you should prioritize your time and like within an organization, like, you know, how you should prioritize between different actions. I just realized that like people had really sort of put a lot of thought into sort of like how to apply this concept consistently. I guess so that was like a huge shift. I guess like after that, I mean, effective altruism has changed. So there is now like more of an emphasis on AI, for instance. But I guess like my thinking about like the concept itself hasn't changed that massively. Like, I mean, as it happened, like I was asked to give a talk about like cause neutrality, this concept that I mentioned at the start, like a few weeks ago. And then I sort of brought up a talk from 7 years ago, and like basically the sort of the basic ideas from that were sort of still valid. So I think the basic framework it hasn't changed that much, but sort of like how we apply it that has changed. I guess like also this idea of the virtues that we mentioned previously, that was something that I thought about from early on. But then, like, I mean, to be honest, I think also like this whole FTX crash was also like one reason why I wanted to emphasize it, especially. So I think that sort of like way of thinking about effective altruism was always important. But, you know, now I find that was sort of confirmed by that unfortunate turn of events.
Be good to hear a bit more about what exactly when you were at LSE drew you towards effective altruism, and whether or not you think many people in EA have a kind of certain personality type. Is there a certain kind of person, maybe a certain kind of person who likes being quite logical and rational, like gets drawn towards these ideas?
First of all, we didn't really study that in our book. So like, you know, sometimes when I say tell people that, you know, we've written this book about the psychology of effective altruism, then people think that, oh, you've studied the sort of the members of the EA community. But like, I mean, someone should do that. But that's not really what we did. We, you know, mostly did studies of the broader public and their attitudes to effectiveness. But like more anecdotally, like, I mean, it does actually seem to me like people come to EA from like somewhat different, in somewhat different directions. Like, so some people have sort of like been working on some specific course, and then they've just found out that like, well, it's really important to be effective. And then, but like, whereas I think I was always interested in rationality and the sort of like enlightenment tradition. And like, so that was something that, led me to go into philosophy in the first place. But then, so I think that analytic philosophy, which is the sort of kind of philosophy that one mostly does in both in Sweden and in the English speaking world, which is this sort of like kind of approach to philosophy which tries to be very precise, but that sometimes that is at the expense of sort of like real world relevance. So I thought that like, well, you know, this is a great tool, but like, you know, it should be applied more practically. So that was something that I had thought since previously, and then I discovered this effective altruism community, and also actually the Less Wrong website. So maybe I should briefly say some words about Less Wrong. So this is this website which is dedicated to like improving human rationality and understand rationality. It's also a lot about existential risk presently. So they had this website where it was like basically a forum which discussed rationality. I thought that that was like surprisingly good for being an internet forum, which are usually not like up to that standard. So I got involved with that, and then I learned about effective altruism as well. So like when I discovered like the Less Wrong and the EA community, then I thought a bit like, well, did that sort of like, it wasn't like I had been thinking about like, well, those specific things, but I had since previously had this idea in trying to apply philosophy. And I think that both of these groups do that basically.
There may be sometimes some criticism and some objections towards effective altruism. Is there anything that kind of stands out of your mind as sometimes being a bit of a valid criticism? Anything you think the effective altruism kind of set of ideas of movement could do differently? Any thoughts around this kind of thing?
I think, first of all, I actually think some of the criticisms are a bit unfair and sort of like build on a sort of like sort of a strawman view of effective altruism. But like I guess like this thing with the sleepwalk bias is something that I've been thinking sometimes, that sort of like maybe people were sort of like they're sometimes underestimating the extent to which sort of like institutions actually do react to problems, and that may sometimes lead to sort of like being a bit too pessimistic. And I could see also that like this is something that some outside critics sort of like an intuition that sort of underlies some outside criticism. They might not have thought about it very, very carefully, but like I think that they, like, sort of in the back of their mind, they might have a view like that. That's sort of like, you know, many things do actually work out fine in the end. I mean, that is of course like not an argument against, like, you know, working on an area, because like they only become fine because like someone does something about it. But like, it still matters to have like an accurate worldview, I think.
One thing I've sometimes heard is maybe like EA is a bit of an elitist kind of group that thinks about and spends money, especially more, I hear this with AI, on, you know, these unlikely risks that are very abstract and unusual. What would you say about this kind of...
I mean, so with regards to the sort of with the AI risk issue in particular, I mean, I do think that like, if someone thinks that that's not the most important cause, like, then they need to present a like precise argument against it. They can't just sort of like hand wave in the direction of sort of like, well, that's something that, of course, like this sort of like Silicon Valley inspired kinds of people would say. Like, I mean, that's just not good enough. Like, but you know, if they present a convincing argument, then we would need to respond to that. But like, sometimes I feel like a fair amount of criticism is on this quite hand wavy and a sort of like a level, and it's sort of like a bit acerbic. And basically, I don't take it very seriously, to be honest.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier about something like the unfortunate events with Sam Bankman-Fried. And, you know, he obviously said he himself was an effective altruist. He gave lots of money. Were there any reflections you had on that whole set of events? And if indeed it did mean anything for effective altruism, those involved, where money was sent and so on?
I'm sure there are sort of things that EA organizations should think about. But like, I'm not sort of like deeply involved in sort of like the management of those organizations. But there, I'm sure there are ways, things to think about there. But I guess, yeah. So I guess what I could say is like relates more to the sort of like broader mindset and so on. Like, so yeah, I do think that this means that we need to really emphasize even more the importance of, because I think that people did emphasize that to an extent even before, that the sort of like the importance of following common sense virtues and so on. But I think that that's something that one needs to focus on even more. And I like, but that, I mean, that's maybe like a bit bland and obvious, but then like something that might be a little bit less bland is that like, maybe one should be a bit more cautious with doing sort of some types of things which are sort of highly unconventional in general. So, I mean, it's a bit tricky because like a course area like AI risk, that was sort of like highly... that was seen as very weird at the beginning, and now people say that like, well, it's become more mainstream. So it is important to be sort of like open to some sort of like highly surprising ideas. But I guess I think that like, especially when it comes to sort of the types of behavior and sort of like ways that you run an organization and things like that, there I think that basically in society there's sort of like developed you know, certain norms and certain ways of thinking about like how to do this, and many of them are actually there for good reasons. And there's a little bit of a risk that, like, you know, that one has a sort of like this sort of naive effective altruist mindset to them, and sort of like, you know, just ignore certain rules or certain norms. So I guess I'm saying that, like, you know, you can take different approaches to questions like that as well, but you need to really think very carefully about it. So yeah, that is potential update.
How can someone go about trying to become a more critical, deeper thinker and more rational?
It's actually not that hard to improve in some ways. Like so if you think about it, like, there are many people who are sort of like debating online, and then they're just saying random stuff and arguing via memes or whatnot. But then, like, the very same people, you know, they sort of write an essay in school, or, like, you know, they do something professionally and so on. And then they adopt a very different mindset. Like, then they are actually more careful. Like, I mean, not everyone, but, like, my point is that, like, there is this sort of, like, other mindset which is available for us. And you know, we can switch into that. And it's actually not as hard as, you know, you might think. So just sort of like adopting that mindset. Like, suppose that you're like a lawyer and there's an important case here, and, like, you know, you really need to get everything right. Like, if you have that attitude when you discuss politics or something, like, that would do a lot to improve you, I think.
Okay, so final question. So I actually ask every guest the same question to end the episode. Final question, Stefan, is what do you think it means to live a good life?
I think there isn't, like, I mean, it highly depends on who you are and, like, what your preferences are. So basically, I think, like, every person has to sort of, like, try quite hard to find out that for themselves, because, you know, often I think this is also like something that's hard for young people. Like, they don't really know who they are and, like, what their preferences are. So you need to sort of like gradually try to find out about, like, you know, what is it that you really desire, and what is it that you just think that you want, but, like, actually it's like something that, like, people in your peer group like, and therefore, like, you just go along with that or so that's important. And then you also, of course, like, have to think about, like, well, what's feasible to do, like, because, like, there are some things that you might want to do, and then, like, you just that path is blocked, it's too difficult. If you're able to navigate all of that in a good way, then hopefully you'll have a good life.
All right, Stefan, this is really interesting and insightful. Thanks so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, Joe.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below. And I hope to see you here again.